Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Hello, I'm Stuart Alexander, and once again, I would like to welcome our listeners to The Socialist Insight. Today, we have a very exciting guest that I met last year in New York when I was running as a candidate for President of the United States, and he invited me to come and speak with students there at a school where he is a high school teacher. It's called City as Schools High School. And today we have on our program is John Antosh. And John, thanks again for thanks for joining the program today.
I'm happy to be with you. This is exciting for me.
And John, that was a very exciting time when you invited me to come there and speak with the students. There was approximately 25 students that participated, and you had many of the faculty members there at the school that came and participated in that session. So, again, I would like to thank you, even though it's been a year ago since we did that. Thanks again. John, you are a member of a group which is part of the United Federation of Teachers. It's called MORE. It's the Movement of Rank and File Educators. John, could you tell us a little bit about what MORE is all about?
Sure. MORE is a caucus within the United Federation of Teachers, my union, which represents public school employees and daycare workers in New York City. And the MORE caucus was started just within the last little over a year ago because we wanted to, we felt like our union wasn't doing enough to address a lot of the issues that are facing public school teachers right now, and we wanted to fight for a democratic union, to have a union that would take seriously the idea that students' conditions are our conditions and that we need to work together with parents and students, and to demand more democracy in our schools and more of a say for teachers, parents, and students.
And seem like MORE has, they have been a wake-up call for people to become an energizer within the unit, within the union, because seem like a lot has been happening since with many of the members getting more, bringing in more involvement since MORE has been around. What are you actually doing in the union yourself? I mean,
well,
within
I'm
MORE.
A delegate for my school chapter of the UFT, and I'm also a member of MORE. That I've been very active in putting together our platform, and recently we ran in the UFT elections, which just concluded last Thursday. And we didn't run in the elections in order to, with the idea that we were going to take over the union, but to really put forward an idea of having a militant and also social justice-oriented union. And we actually managed to win 40% of the high school vote, which is very significant compared to the current leadership, which is called the Unity Caucus, won 45% of the high school vote. And so it shows that people do want a more militant, more democratic, mobilizing model of unionism, and one that is going to hook up with parents and teachers and community concerns, because that's the we use it as a as an opportunity to create a network, to talk to teachers. It's the during the election time, we have the legal right to go into schools and put election materials in every UFT member's mailbox. And so we tried to do that, and we had a lot of conversations, met a lot of people, and we brought people out to protests against school closings. We sponsored a couple of different forums, one on the Seattle test boycott. And, you know, we're trying to build more of a militant trade union presence in the face of, you know, a feeling that teachers really are under attack.
Right.
And I think we've met a lot of teachers around the city that are responding to the idea that we need to fight back against corporate education reform, and that it's up to regular teachers to take things into their own hands and to push our union to do more, but also just to reach out to parents, students, and do what we can ourselves to fight back.
And what we're going to do is we're going to talk a little bit more, we're going to talk more about corporate education reform, because we can see what corporate education reform is all about. It's all about privatizing tax dollars and the create a profitable system only for the wealthy few in our society. But one of the things I found very interesting, you have quite a few members within the union. I keep saying unit. You had 173,000 ballots that were sent out for this election that you just had. And out of that, 75% of those didn't even bother to respond. You had 43,000 that actually participated in voting. Why was that?
Well, I think that teachers are somewhat alienated from their union, you know, unfortunately. And we didn't have the capacity to reach everybody that we could have reached. And in addition, you know, getting people to believe that participating in this could make a big difference. It's hard. People are a bit cynical. Some of them are a bit beaten down. And although, you know, the other thing is that the union really hasn't made it participation as meaningful as it should be. And so I think that for a lot of people...
And why is that?
Well, I think for a lot of people now, a lot of members over the years have felt that, you know, if we have a pension, if we have raises, then everything's okay, and we're going to leave it to the leadership to take care of things. And I think the leadership, for their part, unfortunately, have taken a very compromised attitude towards the powers that be, and I can relate to that. Yeah,
I can definitely relate to that, because I've been a member of several unions myself. But anyway, finish your thought on that, John.
Well, you know, it could be a combination of careerism, people viewing the union as a platform to go on and do other things. But I think, you know, the union bureaucracy, the union staff, is not oriented really towards trying to draw out the participation of members very much. So I can talk about that a little bit later, but, you know, they're not calling upon the members to do things. And I'll tell you something, it's tough sometimes as a rank-and-file member of a union to try to put out ideas to members and convince them that they should take things up because they've been so sort of conditioned by the official leadership to just sit back and wait upon lawsuits or endorsements for politicians to pan out, you know, and things of that nature. And it really has been a problem.
And John, I would just like to ask you, in regards to yourself as an individual, what inspired you to get into teaching, and what is it like teaching in your school where you're at?
Okay, well, I've been teaching for 12 years at a school that I really like. All 12 years of my career have been at City Ed School High School.
Oh, you started there?
I started there, and I've stayed there my whole career so far. I got into teaching. I was involved in community organizing, community labor organizing with a group called NMAS, National Mobilization Against Sweatshops. And we were very inspired by some organizing that had been going on in Chinatown among immigrant workers with an independent workers center called the Chinese Staff and Workers Association.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that getting involved in teaching would give me an opportunity to connect with young people and to learn about the kinds of problems that that they're having. And I had an interest in history. I had an interest in economics and things like that from a left perspective. And I thought, you know, this is an opportunity for me to learn how to connect these kinds of ideas with young people's experiences and what they're going through. And I'll tell you something. Most the turnover for younger teachers starting now is very high. Most people don't make it past the fourth year. But I've been very happy at my school. It's an alternative school where the students do internships as part of their weekly schedule. And I did place one or two students over at the headquarters of the Socialist Party USA, actually, which has been an opportunity for them to learn about the idea of democratic socialism.
Well, it's good to hear that.
yeah. So they're, you know, they've been working with Greg
Payson.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So, you know, it really is a good program. But one thing I'll get into about later is that they're grading schools now in New York based on absenteeism and student test scores. And our school, which is what they call a transfer school, which means that students transfer into it. And quite often we get students that, you know, were very unhappy with regular schools for various reasons, or some of them were having problems with their other schools. And so they come to City of School, and a good part of our population is what you would call at-risk students. But we just got our second C grade. And what that means is if we get a third C based on, you know, largely absenteeism and test scores, they could close the school.
Mm-hmm.
So
what is being done to improve that?
Well, in terms of the pressure it puts on us as teachers, we're making more. I mean, we've always been making an effort to call home, talk to parents about absenteeism and so forth. In addition, you know, our classes, we're an unusual school, as I said, in the sense that our students, we are exempt from most of the tests because
mm-hmm.
we're in what they call a portfolio school, which is something
mm-hmm.
I really support. It means that students are evaluated based on a portfolio of their various work. But we do have to have the students take the Regents English Language Regents test. And, you know, so we're really cutting down on some of our other classes to try to make sure that students can answer multiple choice questions and write certain kinds of essays, read certain kinds of texts. It's not all bad, but it certainly narrows what you're able to do with students, and it doesn't necessarily speak to their own interests, especially when you have these alienated young people, many of them. Some of the stuff we have to do with them doesn't help now. But so that's part of it. But Moore wants to fight school closings, and now that the election is over, we're in the process of figuring out what our strategy is going to be going forward to build a citywide citywide moratorium on school
right.
closings.
Well, when you talk about school closing, what impact do you see? I mean, what is actually taking place in the city? One of the things that I look at is that there is a problem there in New York and, of course, in other cities throughout the country where there's a movement to terminate the position of teachers throughout the city. And, of course, much of this is not even being disclosed to the public where they can see how widespread this is. But schools also closing. I mean, education is in a crisis, but what is happening with the schools that are closing? Because we need to have more schools, not less. We need to have more teachers, not more teachers being fired or terminated. But what is going on in the city that most people are not hearing? What is taking place in education there that we're not hearing?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to answer that, but most directly with the school closings, Mayor Bloomberg, who is finishing his third term now, established what is called mayoral control back in 2002. And part of that is that he took on the authority to close schools, and they abolished what previously had existed, the Board of Education, and I can go into this a little bit more later, but essentially he's used his power to close down many schools in the city. And what happens when they close, we in New York, because of our union contract, we still don't have straight up layoffs. So what
right.
happens? In other words, you can get fired from a school, but you're still an employee of the city. So what they've done is, when they close a school because it got 3C grades or it got D's or F's,
mm-hmm.
they generally fire half of the staff of that school, and then they start a new school where they fire everyone. Then they start a new school where they generally hire back only 50% of the original staff. The other 50% becomes part of a floating pool of teachers that's used for daily substitute work. And believe it or not, they have them going around the schools. Switching schools once a week. So, for example, in my school, every week I can go down to the main office and there'll be a different worker coming through who's, they call it absent teacher reserve, ATR,
mm-hmm.
Absent teacher reserves. So because the mayor also took away what's called, and the union agreed to, unfortunately, seniority transfer rights, which used to mean that union teachers, if we were going to transfer from one school to another, all else being equal, the person who had more seniority, you know, qualifications being equal, the person with more seniority would get the first shot at that school. The union negotiated that away, so that doesn't exist anymore. In addition, the mayor changed the structure of funding so that each school became responsible for its own budget, and rather than it used to be that each school would get money based on the average teacher's salary, but they changed it so that each school would have to pay the full salary for each teacher. So that created a situation: take away seniority transfer rights, fire half the teachers in the school. Who is the new school going to hire back? They're only going to hire back the lower salary teachers. Who are the lower
right.
salary teachers? They're the younger teachers. So essentially, you could almost say there is no more seniority in the New York City public school system. The more years
right.
you have in, the less job security you have.
Right.
I mean,
I'm starting
like,
to understand why the 75% of the people didn't cast their votes.
yeah. So it
you
really
know, one
is,
of the things I can relate to. I was back in the 70s, I was part of the Retail Clerks Union here in California, and also I was I was involved with the Teamsters when I was in trucking and transportation, and also the Machinists Union when I was in aerospace. But very interesting, and back to the 75% of the people, as you mentioned, not voting. But you
yeah.
see the unions, many times they're not really supporting the will of the members. And one of the things I saw when I was with the Teamsters back in the 80s, the union, they were negotiating some benefits and wages for the union members, and I was working for a company here in Los Angeles. And subsequently what happened is not only did we lose part of our wages, the truck drivers and the warehouse workers, but we also lost some of our benefits as well. And, you know, and you see the same thing happening, well, when I was with the retail clerks, but members, when they don't see the unions performing, they become very discouraged. Do you see the process in the way that the UTF and many unions today, John, do you see it as being a very democratic process for the people that are part of the rank and file?
Not at all, and I'll tell you something. Compared to some other unions, we may have the appearance of being much more democratic. If we have a delegates assembly that meets once a month that I go to, we have chapter meetings where people can say what they want in our schools, and people go to those chapter meetings. Although I'll tell you, there are schools that don't even have functioning chapters right now. They don't have chapter leaders or functioning chapters. But when you go to these delegate assembly meetings, essentially it's Robert's Rules of Order, and the union president, Michael Mulgrew, talks for, I don't know, half an hour giving a report, and he has various staff give reports. And you just get the feel that it's a rubber stamp. It's very, very hard to raise
anything.
Yeah,
I saw that 30 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. It really
like a rubber stamp.
Yeah, like a rubber stamp. It is like a rubber stamp. And it unfortunately, just as we're sort of alienated from our workplaces, our unions, which are supposed to be where we come together as workers, have really gotten out of the regular people's control. It's really a
now
problem.
What Moore is trying to do, what Moore is doing, they're trying to change things in the union, and they're trying to change things with the members, where the rank and file will be more active and be part of the decision-making process rather than just dealing with a rubber stamp. Is that correct? Because
that's
what
right.
I can see is very your activism. Is just incredible. I mean, when you consider, I think you say you've been around for just over a year, correct?
Right, that's right. Moore
right.
has just been around
and,
for over
and
a
already
year.
This caucus is completely on fire.
One of the things
that you mentioned just before we began the program today, which, you know, a lot of people, obviously, they went to the polls and they voted for Barack Obama. There was a lot of excitement, obviously, in 2008. And when I met you in 2012, I didn't even remotely think that I was going to be the president in 2000 at the end of the year. But the thing is, a lot of people did vote for this president. Of course, we know Bush had the program No Child Left Behind, and of course Obama, you know, is the race to the top. You say this is one thing that has also affected has created a lack of interest and participation for many of the teachers. But the thing is, these are the same people over the last few years that voted for this president. Why would these programs, along with the president that has implemented these programs, why would it be a turnoff to the same people that actually went to the polls and voted for him in 2008 and again in 2012?
Well, race to the top, Barack Obama's program for education.
And trust me, I don't support the program.
Yeah. I mean, it largely amounted to a continuation of George Bush's No Child Left Behind. It's advancing. It tied federal money to raising caps on charter schools. It's demanding what they call accountability, but which really means use of standardized tests to measure student so-called progress, which doesn't really, most experts will tell you that that doesn't really indicate what someone's really, the quality of what somebody's learned, just alone, a standardized test. They're using the student test scores to then evaluate whether the teachers are adding what they call adding value to the student. And it is a very data-driven system that, even though you know, public schools are still public, it sounds like the bottom line of a corporation, just
mm-hmm.
trying to crunch
right.
things down. It's kind of like Taylorism, you know, trying to bring de-skill things down to a very quantifiable, simplistic level, so that we're churning out these units. And if you think about it, what you end up with is students that are skilled at taking tests, responding to directions when the bell rings, sitting in a chair, not speaking until spoken to, and just following these jumping through these hoops. And you're not, and the ones that can do that well, they go up the ladder. The ones that have trouble with that, you know, it's totally fine to have a pool of, you know, less educated labor, basically. And
right.
it's not teaching students how to think critically or to be active democratic citizens or to learn to think about how the economy really works or things like that.
Right.
So, yeah.
Well, when you talk about standardized testing, how is that affecting the teachers' working conditions?
I'll tell you. It's terrible. It's bad enough for the students. I mean, most people, of course, don't like standardized tests. But what's happening with teachers is that, as I mentioned, they have these new evaluation systems that they're enforcing around the country. In New York, we have something called the Danielson system that's going to be coming down in September, I believe, where a large chunk of how they evaluate teachers and how they grade us will be based on our students' test scores. And so what that means is, you know, at my school right now, I have a great deal of freedom to teach students about, you know, you weren't the only person I brought, Stuart. I brought a representative of the Green Party. I brought
right, and you had mentioned
a guy,
that.
Yeah, and a guy from the Libertarian Party came, and a Republican.
And you had other ones that you say didn't show up.
No, they came. They came.
Yeah,
they
appeared. But what you had mentioned to me at the time that you had actually invited quite a few. You had invited many of the other candidates to come and participate.
You were the only candidate to show up, and not only that, I couldn't find a really good supporter for Barack Obama willing to come to my high school. It was I did end up getting somebody good, but he wasn't somebody who was campaigning for Barack Obama or anything like that, and he was all right. But you were definitely the most engaging, and it was the whole staff was excited to have you. I think they wanted to hear about an alternative because they, especially as teachers, we could see
right.
that.
Right, and it definitely was very engaging, the teachers, the faculty, and I look forward to making a visit back there to city, a schools, high school sometime in the future. Today, I just want to mention at this time that we do have John Ash Antosh. He's joining our program today. We're having a discussion about education and also a program, he's with the United Teachers Federation, and also he is with MORE, and MORE is Movement of Rank and File Educators. Recently they had elections, And in those elections, he's talking about the results of that. And, John, once again, I would like to thank you for joining the program today.
I'm really happy to be here, Stuart.
John, so, I'm going to just go in a slightly different direction because, you know, I want to get into what the crisis that we are facing with education today. And much of that crisis has to do with the corporate influence that is looking at education as a means of profit. What has been the impact of corporate reforms on the New York City school system?
Well, there's a few different angles to corporate reform, and it's spreading across the country. You have these testing companies like Pearson selling their test prep materials to school boards and to states, and you have also this push for charter schools, which are many of them are run by nonprofits, but they're run by corporations. Okay, charter schools are run by either for-profit or nonprofit corporations, and the concept actually comes down from the Bush era, or even before that, perhaps the Reagan era. This idea of providing greater competition among schools to generate better results. And so what happens is, as when I was talking earlier about how there's been a rash of school closings in New York, they often replace them with these charter schools.
Charter schools, right.
Get money from the city, but they're run and managed by private corporations. Sometimes they are nonprofit corporations, but even these nonprofit corporations, the CEOs of them, make some of them, millions.
Over $1 million sometimes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So what's happened, and in addition, they're not union schools for the most part. There's been some effort to unionize them, but the charters are exempt from all of the rules that apply to the union schools in New York. The other thing they've tried to do is they've tried to introduce something called merit pay, which means that teachers would be eligible for additional pay if they are able to raise their students' test scores and things like that. And one of my fellow Moore members was at a school where they tried to experiment with merit pay. They tried to get the staff to accept it, and the staff turned it down because they said, we don't want to compete with each other over these kind of crumbs. We want to work together collaboratively
right. At
the school mm-hmm. level to get the best results for all of the students. We don't want to, one person is hoping that the other person isn't going to do as well so that they can do better and get extra money and things like that. So it's the corporate mentality, it's the style of private corporations being imported into the public setting. And it's having a devastating, I think it's, a lot of it is driving the change to charter schools, the standardized testing, and the cuts to public education. They want to, it's like a private company, they want to turn out more widgets for less money, so it's a corporate mentality. They don't care about the fact that there are young people here who are learning things for the first time, learning how to read, learning about history, politics, all those things. None of that matters to them. So,
right. And as you mentioned, when you look at corporations, they're not concerned with the value of education and how we are going to be able to educate our children and where is going to be the future of this nation. The only thing they're looking at is well over $500 billion and how can they turn these public funds into profit. And that is that's what's happening with our corporate education, with the way that we have the crisis that is currently taking place in education. One of the other things that when we talk about the crisis in education, many people have talked about the existence of schools to prison pipeline. What ways have you seen evidence of this, John?
I'll tell you, we deal with in my school a lot of young people who did feel pushed out of other schools, and there's been an emphasis on, first of all, when you have inadequate resources in regular public schools, classrooms are overcrowded, there isn't enough funding for counselors and guidance services and even regular material, coupled with, you know, test prep is the curriculum and not things that are relevant to people's lives, there's going to be greater disengagement from the school. And in addition, there's also been pressure put on schools to push out low test scorers. So if a kid's not going to score well on the test, a lot of schools try to get rid of them, and in particular the charter schools, but even other, even just regular public schools. Charter schools, many of them use what are called zero tolerance policies, which mm-hmm. means using a severe punishment even for very minor so-called disruptive behaviors. And, students have been expelled for all kinds of silly things. There's been an increase in suspensions. And they also have a lot more police in schools now. So there's increased reliance on police to maintain discipline in schools. And there's been a rise in school-based arrests.
Now, what is the connection between what has taken place, what you just mentioned, and a city and a society that is moving toward privatizing education? Because it seemed like we'll create the crisis and then we'll present our solutions, and the solutions always seem to be that we need to privatize the schools and take the better of the students, and the other ones we'll just throw them in prison.
Well, I'll tell you something. Having a loose labor market rather than a tight labor market, having an increase in unemployment, from employers' perspectives, is not necessarily a bad thing. And
they look at it as cheap labor.
Yeah, and so on the other hand, if there's too many students that are not prepared for jobs and so forth, then if there are other sources of inexpensive labor, I mean, for example, bringing in undocumented workers or you can crack down on them, but keep them as a pool of off the books
labor. A labor pool.
Yeah. A lot of my students work in restaurants and in, you know, Burger Kings, pizza parlors. Some of them are baggers in grocery stores. It's interesting. Teenagers work the same jobs that immigrants work, and they compete in the same labor market. And at any rate, I think that the system doesn't really care to educate a large percentage of the population. But you have to do something with them, and I suppose the prisons is a different way that others can make money off of them, for one thing.
One time here in California, we had it was just over 173,000 inmates in the California prison system, and it was just a revolving door. And a federal judge has actually mandated that they need to reduce that population. But they were, and then Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, before he went out of office, he was already calling for 8 more prisons. Under Pete Wilson, they had built an additional 22, which took it up to 33 prisons. And then Arnold Schwarzenegger, he was saying that he wanted an additional 8 prisons. So instead of spending money on building schools and where they could, you know, build toward the future of the country, only thing they were concentrating on is how could they put more individuals, incarcerate more individuals. And people need to understand that that was at a cost of $40,000 per year per inmate. So it's the wrong priorities that we have as a country. So as you mentioned, many of these persons, you know, they're not receiving a good education. They end up being out on the street, or they end up going to prison. Back to what we were just mentioning, speaking about just a few minutes ago, schools to prison pipeline. Another thing I wanted to ask you, John, and once again, I just want to mention we have John Antosh. He's with he is a teacher there in New York City, and he is with the City at School High School there in New York. John, could you explain some of the issues surrounding school governance in New York City?
Yes, as I mentioned earlier, in 2002, Mayor Bloomberg took control of the school system in a system that's called mayoral control. And he took on the ability then to appoint the chancellor, to set policies, create budgets, and he got rid of the school boards, the locally elected school board, and created something called the Panel for Education Policy, that it has a majority of members that are directly appointed by him. And
now, what I would like for you to do is explain what has been the impact since that was instituted, because they were trying to do something very similar to that in Los Angeles, and that was shot down. And that was with Mayor Anthony Villaraigosa there in Los Angeles, Villaraigosa. But how that was something that he had introduced. How effective has that program been, or ineffective, since he took control of the school system there?
Well, the argument in favor of it was that it was supposed to root out local corruption in the school boards, that people don't really care who's on their local school board, and in fact that the local school boards often played favoritism and things like that. But in fact, what's happened is it's taken maybe wasn't the most participatory system that existed before, but the system that existed before at least allowed, there was an opportunity for people to participate. And in fact, there were people from different neighborhoods, and particularly black and Latino neighborhoods and low-income neighborhoods in New York City. It was an arena where, an unusual arena for people to be able to put out ideas, take set policies and so forth. All of that's been taken away. And
it's been taken away.
All that's been taken away, and instead of local school boards, they've been completely abolished. We have the Panel on Education Policy that the mayor appoints 8 of the people who sit on it directly, and essentially they have never voted against anything he's called for. And so they're the ones that cast the vote to close schools or to bring in charter schools. And essentially, the mayor, they just recently voted to close 22 more schools. And, essentially, there's no recourse for people. You just have to wait for the next mayor if you don't like something. In addition, they've worked very closely with certain charter companies, and whereas before people said, oh, the local school boards are maybe playing favorites or something like that, now we had a situation where the PEP, the Panel on Educational Policy, the mayor's people call it the mayor's puppets, renewed a $4.5 million contract with something called Champion Learning, which is a charter school corporation, even though they had previously been found to improperly bill the city for $6 million. So instead of local corruption, now there's more big-time corruption, you could say. And
right.
Some of it might be some of it might be more legal, but it's certainly worse in terms of the corporate reform through the charter schools, through the standardized testing, all of these things that have been forced down on people. And I've been to several PEP meetings. They have to go through the motion of having these panel hearings, and students and teachers and parents from these schools that are getting closed often go. They always go to these hearings and protest and hold up signs. And I've been to hearings where they shouted down the PEP, and it just doesn't matter. They stamp. I shouldn't say it doesn't matter. It does matter because it allows mm-hmm. people to come together and voice right. their concerns. And we've gotten the media, and we've gotten the attention of some of the mayoral candidates. But ultimately, we don't have the power to reverse these decisions. And there was one occasion where they did vote, the PEP did vote against what the mayor wanted, having to do with these standardized tests for third graders. He wanted them to impose standardized tests on third graders, and they voted against it. And the next day, he fired his three appointees that had voted against him, and just replaced them. So that's mayoral
total
control.
Total corruption.
Yeah.
You
well, there's no democracy.
You know, you
in
got
it.
You got the attention of the media, but I wanted to ask, how do you respond to media stories that portray the teachers' union as the enemy of students and families? And also, if you can elaborate, what are some of the bread and butter issues teachers are facing in New York City right now?
Well, our slogan, the slogan of MORE, Movement of Rank and File Educators, is that our working conditions are our students' learning conditions. And
so
what
why
by
is the media, based on what you're seeing right now, why would the media be portraying you as an enemy? An enemy of students and families. Why?
Well, for example, they go after what they call LIFO, last in, first out, which means tenure, essentially. And so they're saying Michelle Rhee, who was one of the big corporate reform leaders, who was a former chancellor of D.C. public schools, said, you know, teacher tenure has no educational value at all. And essentially they're trying to say that the union protects lousy teachers, that teachers shouldn't have a job security, they should be able to be fired by managers and principals. And essentially there's no thought to the idea that having a stable job, first of all, tenure just means that there's a grievance process. It doesn't necessarily mean, it does not mean that somebody cannot be fired ever. It just means that they can't be fired at will, that there's a process. And there are plenty of terrible managers and principals out there that don't necessarily, there's been a dwindling number, for example, of Black and Latino teachers in the New York City system. The fact that there isn't this, as I was talking about before, now we have a system where the more years you have in, the less security you have, because they have loosened up, they have made it so that, in fact, teachers don't really have job security by closing and reopening all these schools.
Right.
And creating this floating population of teachers who are just used for absentee, substitutes for absent teachers, it's created chaos for the students. It's created chaos for the teachers as well, and so we have not been working with a contract for the last 4 years. Our last contract was passed in 2006, and
right.
We haven't had an increase, an improvement in our condition since then. We are working under the old contract, and in fact, right now there are no public employees in New York City working under a contract. All of the contracts have expired, and it's creating a real problem because for whoever is the next mayor, because there's going to be 300,000, approximately 300,000 public workers who are trying to get new contracts, wages, and better conditions, and it's going to be
a real fight.
It's going to be a real fight, yeah. In addition, I've talked about the uh-huh. new evaluation system for teachers. That's based partially on the test scores, that the standardized tests that the students take. So that right there shows you we have to teach to the test, which means rote drilling largely, or teaching test-taking skills. So that is not good for the students. And then it's bad for the teachers because then we are evaluated largely based on the scores that our students get on these tests. So, all of these things are bad for students and bad for teachers.
We have approximately 9 more minutes, and today we have John Antosh. He's with the City at Schools High School in New York City. And, John, before we end our program, I have a couple more questions that I would like to ask. But I would like to ask, do you have a contact where our listeners can be able to contact you if they have any questions that they would like to send you either through a whether it's Facebook or whether it's a Twitter or email? How would our listeners be
Absolutely.
Able to
contact
people you?
Can sure. People could look me up on Facebook if they want. That's fine.
And could you spell your name so they would know how to
sure,
pull it up?
Sure. And you could also send me an email if you want. So my name. So my email is my name. So it's J-O-H-N, John, Antush, A-N-T-U-S-H, at Gmail.
And, John, as I mentioned, we just have a couple more questions that I would like to ask. Excuse me. What has been the impact of the Chicago strike on teachers there in New York?
The Chicago teacher strike has had an electrifying impact on the people involved in Moore, certainly. The activists that are looking for a model of how to work with parents, communities, and to have a democratic union. And I think that beyond the core of activists involved in Moore, teachers who may be, they're not particularly active, they're not feeling like it's possible to do anything very good, I think it really raised their consciousness about the fact that it is possible to take a job action. It is possible to get improvements, even in this bad climate. And one of the things that they did that was very significant, I think, is they, in Chicago, when they arrived at a potential agreement on the contract, they said, hold on a moment, we need to have our members at the chapter level review what this contract says in the schools. And they took, I don't know, I think a couple of days for people to read and discuss the contract, discuss it with their delegates, and then have a meeting where it was voted on. And, that sort of thing certainly doesn't go on it didn't go on in 2006 when we had our last contract approval, in terms of that kind of discussion in the midst of negotiating, but as part of the process. So I think that we had Moore did organize solidarity with the Chicago strike. We had a demonstration in New York, actually against Democrats for Education Reform, because Rahm Emanuel, of course, was Obama's is from the Obama administration.
Was his chief of staff.
Yeah, and Chicago is Obama's hometown. So political hometown. So, you know, I think that the Chicago teacher strike has national significance for the labor movement and for teachers and for workers.
John, when I made the visit there to your school last year about the same time, one of the questions came up when I was speaking with the students was about students being able to vote. And I'm talking about students that are younger than 18 years of age. But I just want to ask you, do you think students, let's say 16 years of age and older, should they be allowed to vote in elections?
I think so. I think they should. I think that certainly their lives are being shaped by policies very profoundly already. And I certainly meet a lot of most of my students are a little bit older than that. But I do meet some 16-year-olds, and the ones that I meet are students who got it together to apply and get into my school, and they had the survival instinct to seek it out and to find out about it and get going in it. And, you know, I'll tell you, there are plenty of 16-year-olds who are dealing with life and death issues very independent way.
They're facing life and death issues, and in the inner city, they face that every day. And, John, the final question I have, and then we're going to have you to give you contact information once again. We do have John Antosh. He's with us today. He's a teacher there with the City at School High School there in New York. But, John, the final question I want to ask you today, what does the struggles around education mean for working people?
Well, I think it has to do with having some kind of a control over the institutions that we live in our lives. And, you know, schools are the first institutions that we go into. And the fact that – so we have a public school system, and the fact that it's publicly owned doesn't necessarily mean that it's a democratic system, but it does create the potential for greater democracy, because that school system is supposed to be for the people. It's supposed to be accountable to the people, as opposed to a private corporation, which is just run by the private interests, the owners or the board that run it. And so I think it's very important for, you know, there's been a tremendous bashing of the public sector, and I think it's important to not passively just or not just fight for the public sector in itself, but the public sector can be an arena for people to say, this is ours, this is belongs to the people and is supposed to serve the people. And the other thing is that education shouldn't just be for creating employees. It's to enrich our lives, and it costs resources. It takes a lot of resources to provide worthwhile education for people, and that's not something that we should just reduce to a cost-benefit analysis in terms of churning out workers for private companies or something like that. And the final thing I'd say is that it's very significant for public sector unions and public sector employees, the battles around teachers' rights and public sector employees right now, because it's the last bastion of the labor movement, the old trade union movement anyway, in the United States. So,
And, John, in the future, I would like to invite you back probably within the next 6 weeks or so and discuss education, the crisis that we have in education and solutions from a socialist perspective, because you and I have sat down and talked together before there in New York, and I can see that you understand many of the solutions that we do need to pursue in education from a socialist perspective, and I would like to invite you on in the future. But, John, thanks again for joining the program. I look forward to having you to join us once again.
Thanks a lot, Stuart. It was great to be on.
And thanks again for joining the Socialist Insight. We will have, as our guest next week, will be Alan Mackey, and he will be discussing We as working people, we should be fed up. So that will be next week with Alan Mackey. Thanks again for joining the Socialist Insight, and thank you, John.
Thank you, Stuart.
Have a good
great
night.
To be on. You too.
You're listening to Aramar Tefeo on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience.
Welcome to the Research Rabbit Hole Radio Show with Cynthia Hamill. Tonight, my guest Ron Patton, the owner and publisher of Paranoia Magazine, will be my guest speaker. Ron has been a conspiracy researcher and has an extensive background covering a number of highly controversial conspiracy-related topics. We will be talking. We will be actually taking questions the last 20 minutes of the show at about 5:40 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. So, welcome to the show, Ron Patton. Glad you're on.
Hey, thanks for having me, Cynthia.
Yeah, great to have you on the show. I'm so excited to have you on and talking about your magazine revival. So, tell us a little bit about that.
Well, for those of you who don't know about Paranoia Magazine. It started in 1992 in Providence, Rhode Island. A few artists and conspiracy geeks got together and started to put together their own zine. And so that's how Paranoia was formed. Little did they know that it would really take off and, you know, become, you know, basically recognized as one of the top conspiracy and paranormal magazines in the world. But like a lot of magazines, recently, you know, hit some hard times. They struggled a little bit. And basically, the previous owners, Joan DeArc and Al Hedel, were pretty burned out. And so in 2009, they decided to quit doing the hard copy print magazine. And they just started doing sort of like an anthology or a book once a year. But so about a couple of years ago, I talked to them about, you know, starting my own magazine, and I was going to call it Conspirazine, you know, a conspiracy magazine, and I guess they talked amongst themselves, and they just said, hey, why don't you just buy us out since we're not doing anything with it? It already had name recognition, so a little over a year ago, I purchased the magazine and revived it from dormancy and came out with the first hard copy issue in about 3 years in our summer 2012 publication.
Excellent. Yeah, and I have it from good word from some very highly accredited people within my groups, my research groups, that you have some very discerning articles and some really good stuff. So, and that came from one of my more conservative friends, by the way. So they gave you a lot of accolades on a couple of the articles that they read on mind control and a number of the other topics that you had. So they were pretty impressed with your publication.
Well, good. And I really want to try to keep it as sort of an a magazine that focuses on investigative journalism. And sure, we have a few fringe-type articles, but for the most part, you're going to find it really hard-hitting, kind of edgy, and stuff that you won't normally find in other types of hard copy print publication.
Excellent. Can you give us the links where my audience can find you?
Certainly. You can go to www.paranoiamagazine.com, and that's our website. And they also have contact and subscription information.
Okay.
It comes out quarterly, and $28 a year, and I think it's a pretty good bargain, most people think.
Excellent. Yeah, it sounds great. Very good. Well, we talked earlier about what topics I'd like to cover in the show, and one of the things that keeps coming up every time I'm in a discussion with somebody, typically whether they're in a group-related activity or just meeting people and discussing some of these topics, the term conspiracy theory comes up. And, you know, I've always been fascinated by this because I really never knew what this term meant until taking on some of these, you know, research projects of like looking into 9/11 and the chemtrail thing. And so many people just discard any information that you have on these topics as a, quote, conspiracy theory, end quote. And then they just kind of put it on the shelf and roll their eyes around and look at you like you're an absolute kook. So I'm wondering how we can ground this term and what it actually means, Ron. And I know that you and I had discussed this before and you're very well versed in this. So can you kind of explain to the public what this term is and your understanding of it and how it's kind of been, excuse me, but bastardized in today's you know, terminology when it's coming up in conversations or as a way to actually discredit questions relating to official stories and news stories.
Right. Well, I just think, you know, the public as a whole, for the most part, they're sort of inundated with, you know, cognitive dissonance, right?
Right.
So, you know, basically that's when you have, you know, a feeling of discomfort when you're trying to hold on to two different beliefs or ideas or values or cognitions, and sort of creates like a disequilibrium. And so basically people just don't know what to think. You know, it's too hard to grasp because you have so many different spurious theories out there. But basically, you know, a conspiracy is just, if you look it up in the dictionary, it's just a secret plan by a group to do something unlawful or, you know, an action plotting and some sort of nefarious activity. And this happens in families. It happens in business. It happens in religion. It happens in every aspect of society. So, I mean, we really shouldn't be surprised how prevalent, you know, conspiracies are. I mean, it's used in the court of law all the time, you know, a conspiracy to do this or a conspiracy to do that. And, you know, it's not seen as, you know, something really nebulous or out there when it's used in that context. But, yeah, it's just really interesting. A lot of times people, when they find out what I do, you know, as a conspiracy researcher, they go, oh, so you're a conspiracy theorist. I go, no, not necessarily. You know, there's conspiracy fact and there's conspiracy theory. And, you know, theory is just a supposition or a system of ideas to explain something. So,
right.
I mean, if you look at science, that's what science is, essentially. So, but when you have the two words together, it sort of creates this some sort of nebulous reality that you must be some sort of kook or, you know, somebody who's just way out there who, you know, believes in little green people that are controlling the planet or whatever. So, you know, definitely the two words don't have to be mutually inclusive, but, you know, I think it's just been sort of a gradual process to, you know, kind of create this illusion that conspiracy theorists are a bunch of kooks and they don't use their brain, they're just alarmists and they aren't very logical.
Right. You know, I think that this is so interesting when you look at things with, you know, looking at deciphering the whole story and the official stories of 9/11 and say like the Oklahoma City bombing, you know, when people actually have serious questions in regards to how the media put forth all of the answers immediately, like the first 24 hours, they already had the whole, you know, kit and caboodle already lined up for us. Every belief we were supposed to have believed about this was already on the table. And it's like, you know, how many times does it take, like, over 20 years to even solve one homicide? You know, that's what these crime shows are all about. It's like they can go 20 years and still not have the right person that murdered somebody. But yet on the day of 9/11, They had everybody lined up. Everybody was dialed in. Everybody knew on that day who did this, how it happened, how the buildings fell. They had the whole thing sewed up. I mean, Columbo wouldn't have even had a job at this, you know?
Right.
There was no mystery.
Or, contrarily, what happens, too, is, you know, they might already have the script down, but it seems like even within, you know, recent events, you know, relating to conspiracy, you know, like the Boston Marathon bombing and the Aurora shootings and Sandy Hook, as well as 9/11, which is, you know, the big one, it seems like they really start spinning as far as putting out a lot of different theories. And, you know, that's the mainstream media's job. The CIA essentially controls the media, and William Colby, the former CIA director, you know, said that point blank. CIA controls the media. So we shouldn't really be surprised, should we?
Yeah, I guess we shouldn't be surprised, but it's very confusing, especially when people watch their news and they expect that they're getting the truth, but yet there's so many unresolved questions that are still blatantly out there that, you know, if you even question this, then you're considered a conspiracy theorist. So I think that people need to rework this. This is a whole new paradigm. We need to have a paradigm shift, you know, in regards to this, don't you think?
Oh, very much so. And, you know, relating to this sort of conspiracy theory issue, there was a segment on Rachel Maddow about a week and a half ago, well, right after, actually, they had the Boston Marathon bombing. And, you know, she brought up how conspiracy theorists are, you know, causing the nation to become a bunch of kooks and, you know, sort of like the dumbing down of society. But, you know, what she was doing is she was using, like, logical fallacies such as red herring, you know, distracting from the real issue. And when she said conspiracy theorists, she'd go, conspiracy theorists believe this or that. And, you know, she brought up the 9/11 analysis by Popular Mechanics of debunking all these conspiracy theorists who believed in 9/11. And, of course, you know, she just went, you know, page by page, essentially, of the Popular Mechanics articles who were, you know, trying to debunk the, you know, the 9/11 conspiracy theorist version. But, you know, did she ever mention David Ray Griffin's Debunking the Debunkers, which essentially, you know, sort of proved that, you know, what they were trying to do were using these, you know, logical fallacies, either ad hominem attacks or red herring attacks, and not really getting to the issue. And so what they do is they get involved in these emotionally charged discussions without going point by point.
Right. Yeah, taking each fact within itself, and a lot of them stand on their own. And speaking of that, we had discussed earlier about looking at that list of 24. What were your five top discussion points on the 9/11 facts that you'd like to address?
Well, the five dancing Israelis I found kind of interesting, you know. Just for the fact that, you know, it was in the official police report, right? They were found with, you know, all these box cutters and explosive residue within the car and all this film equipment. And, you know, later it was found out and proven that they were Mossad agents. I think it was called Urban Moving Company, was essentially a Mossad front company. And so even when they went back to Israel, you know, like a month or two later, you know, they were asked, well, why were you there? And they said, well, our purpose was to document the event. Well, how did they know the event was going to happen?
Yeah, I've always wondered that.
Yeah, but I mean, it's all taped and, you know, there for anybody to see.
Yeah, but, it's all over YouTube for sure.
Yeah, and who was the person who helped him, you know, get out of hot water? Michael Chertoff.
the guy who's at the bottom of the didn't he bring in the equipment that is now being used by TSA to do the full body scans?
There you go. I mean, a lot of these people have their, you know, fingers in all kinds of different activities, as well as, of course, you know, Donald Rumsfeld did, you know, prior to the 9/11, and you know, his involvement in all types of questionable stock trading, and it's just there's just so much evidence to substantiate their pre-knowledge of the event.
Right, and along with probably the all the stock option puts that were placed on the two exact airlines, United and American, that their stocks would devalue right after 9/11. So some of those were coming out as early as August the 6th, so over a month and a couple of days before 9/11 even happened. So that's, you know, when you start tying in and looking at all the dots and how all this calculates, it's amazing that more of this news has not come out in our mainstream media, you know, to help people connect dots.
Right, right. And I guess the other point from your list regarding irrefutable facts about 9/11 was, of course, the World Trade Center, building number 7. And, you know, to me, you know, that's just such a smoking gun in regard to proving, you know, that, you know, these buildings came down in a very questionable manner, especially the number 7, which was hardly even touched, per se, but, you know, Larry Silverstein just felt, you know, it was a very odd interview that they had with him, and I still never really understood why he felt that he had to pull it, you know, like to bring it down, just because of, you know, of course, all the loss of life, and he was talking about this, and he just felt compelled that they had to pull it. Made no sense whatsoever. And I believe that there wasn't there like a BBC broadcast prior to Building 7 actually going down?
There were two newscasts that announced 20 minutes before that building even fell that the building had already fallen. And the BBC and Fox News both announced it 20 minutes earlier, and then you have MSNBC and CBS backing them up in two different announcements saying that the building is going to fall. So they knew ahead of time that the building would fall, but I think it was the MSNBC report. The lady's turning around. She's talking with the lady with the baby in her arms. She looks right behind her, and the building's collapsing right like two minutes after she'd said, that building's fixing to fall, you know, so or the building's going to fall, you know. But, I mean, this whole thing doesn't make sense. And when you really start looking at it, there's just so many unanswered questions with all of this.
Yeah, very much so. And I guess the third point I wanted to bring up was just the fact that the 9/11 Commission was so limited, you know, in investigating it as far as the amount of money they put into it, something like $15 million. And, you know, what was the Clinton investigation on Monica Lewinsky, like $60 million or something like that? You know, it's pretty crazy when you think about it. But, you know, to me, it was all planned, you know, somewhat like the Warren Commission when, you know, JFK was assassinated, and even as far back as the Nuremberg trials, you know, where they just basically had those Nazis, you know, especially some of the military personnel that were expendable, but the ones they considered assets, you know, they let go through the Vatican into South America and just, you know, waited for a year or two and then brought them into the U.S. and they became, you know, heavily involved in sort of creating our military industrial complex, as well as our revamped intelligence agencies. So,
yeah,
you know,
a lot of people don't know that history,
right? But to me, that the whole 9/11 commission was just something. It was a farce. It was a sham, and you know, I think as you know, the years have gone by, more of this has been more relative or expressed in various types of alternative media. Yet, for whatever reason, people now almost look at 9/11 as, well, that was so long ago, it's not relevant anymore. But I think we need to really keep on it, because it's sort of the impetus or the focal point of all these other things that have gone on since then. I mean, that's the way I look at it.
Yeah, exactly. That's how I look at it, too. It's like the, you know, it kind of started this whole ball rolling, especially with the Patriot Act bill, you know, coming out 3 weeks after 9/11 happening, and then all of these extraneous wars that were even cited by Wesley Clark as early as 10 days after 9/11 when he visited the Pentagon. So there were seven countries slated right then, and here we are, you know, playing out the scenario years later to the exact T of what was mentioned in Wesley Clark's announcement on the seven countries that we would actually be involved with. So he was right on. They're playing out this entire game plan directly according to what he learned the 10 days after 9/11. So,
right.
Were there any other topics that you felt like were of value with the 24 list that I shared with you?
Well, I mean, you know, the false flag operations I also found pretty intriguing as well, such as, you know, the Gulf of Tonkin, USS Liberty, all these different events that seemed like they were sort of spanned out a number of years. And sometimes it's, you know, difficult to prove, you know, when the events actually occur. But over a period of time, more information becomes readily available. And back then, you know, we didn't have the internet. Whereas now, information flows so much faster that within a few days, we can pretty much tell what's on the up and up, you know. So, again, getting back to all these different sort of conspiratorial events, I believe many of them are false flag operations and, you know, intended to sort of, you know, I mean, it's multifarious, right? It sort of desensitizes, you know, the populace and creates fear. And then there are certain types of legislation that takes place, such as the Patriot Act, and the various types of gun laws that are, you know, really curtailing the American public's rights to bear arms. And, you know, even just go to the airport is something, you know, so.
Yeah, I'm on the same page with you. I feel the same way. I think that they're using these as almost red herrings to look over here while we pass the CISPA bill, you know, like the very week that they're having the Boston Marathon incident and then the Texas fertilizer plant explosion, mm-hmm. that 2 days they passed the CISPA bill. You know, it went straight through the Senate, and not even one person on Facebook announced the CISPA until it had already passed. So I
right.
think that the timing of that, people really need to connect the dots and look at this in a bigger stream, you know, don't you think?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, but, you know, again, I guess the way most people look at things are on a very linear basis. And, you know, I think we discussed at one time about Hegelian dialectics and how dialectics play out, where both sides of an issue are controlled. But, you know, even it seems like people kind of have a basic understanding of that, but they still don't really grasp it. And the more we think in those terms, again, in just a linear fashion and not look in a multi-dimension, you know, from a multi-dimensional perspective, we're just going to be stuck in a rut. And, you know, again, we get back into that cognitive dissonance where it's like, oh, there's just so much going on and there's just so many different theories. What do I believe?
You know, right. Now, can you go over the Hegelian dialect for my audience where they know what this is? From my understanding, it's problem, reaction, solution. But if you could kind of explain that, Ron, because you've had a lot more years doing this. So if you could explain that where my audience understands, that would be great.
Well, essentially, it's a concept or a theory that was developed by a German sociologist by the name of John Hegel. And so I believe what he did is he looked at how the French Revolution sort of came about and all the dynamics that went into play. And his theory was that basically there were these, you know, controlling mechanisms that were in place, but the end result was the same, you know. And so as he looked at different events throughout history, he came with the presupposition or the theory that there's what's called the thesis, right? Like you said, what would be your problem? And then there's
okay.
The antithesis or the antithesis, which is how you respond. You know, that's, you know, sort of diametrically the opposite of your problem. And then there's the synthesis, which is the solution or what they call the desired result. So let's look at, for instance, you know, our political system, our political parties. You know, we have on one hand Republicans and on the other hand we have Democrats. And if, you know, you turn on the news and they're fighting with each other, you know, in Congress or the House of Representatives. But we even, let's say, look, for instance, at Barack Obama and his cabinet and all the people that he hired on once he became president. You know, a lot of those were from the old administration. And so you really have to be introspective and very diligent about looking at things in a totally different way. So, I mean, it's ingenious, really, how dialectics play out. Again, I think in part it's just the way people are educated. You know, our educational system, I think, has a lot to do with that. And I don't think we really teach people how to, you know, look beyond just the surface and to dig and to probe and to look at different angles, you know.
Yes. Have you seen David Icke's video on problem, reaction, solution on the Hegelian dialect?
It was a few years ago when I saw something like that, yeah.
Yeah, he's really animated and he's real kind of upbeat and fun and almost like he does almost like a comedy act with this. But he's talking about how, you know, basically a lot of stuff is staged. You know, it's like they set up a problem and then the people react like, oh, my gosh, we've got to do something, you know, like say we have 9/11 and then people overreact. Their reaction is, oh, my gosh, we've got to do something to protect ourselves, to defend ourselves. So then they create a solution that they've already had, which was like the Patriot Act bill, and then bringing in these TSA scanners and all this stuff. So they already had the backup plan ready to roll before they even had 9/11. So this is part of the staging. And if people can look at that and see how everything is like set up, this is a setup. It's like problem, reaction, solution. And then he said even, you know, the fact that they created something that's not even a problem. Like they make up this weapons of mass destruction and everybody buys into, there's not even a problem. There were no weapons of mass destruction, but yet it plays out like problem, reaction, solution. Here we are going to war with a country that doesn't even have weapons of mass destruction. So we're like believing the story, whether there's, you know, a problem or not, you know?
Right. And I think, sort of in relation to this, you know, an important thing to remember is how much predictive programming is also used when we talk about events like 9/11 or all the recent conspiratorial events that cause a certain amount of trauma within society, and thus that causes a lot of fear and depression. But yeah, predictive programming, it just seems like it's being used so much in all these different types of events. Basically, they're telling us what they're doing. It's, you know, it's a subtle form of psychological conditioning, and most of it is done through the media, right?
Right.
So, you know, it's basically to acquaint the public with, you know, planned societal changes, and thus the masses accept these events as essentially natural occurrences. And there was a conspiracy theorist in the early part of the 1900s named James Shelby Downard, and he really got into this predictive programming, or what's called the twilight language, sort of understanding these concepts in terms of these planned events, but how they sort of like tell the public ahead of time what's going to happen, you know.
So, right.
Another good book is Michael A. Hoffman, Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare, where he shows like there are various types of commercials or advertisements. You know, before Ronald Reagan was shot, it was in different shows and in different ads, you know, about what if the president gets shot, you know, like a week before the president got shot, you know. So it's pretty revealing stuff, but again, that it's just a form of desensitizing the masses through a process of gradualism.
Wow. And did you know that also Congress just passed the, you know, NDAA bill, the National Defense Administration Act bill, and that actually had within it some type of propaganda bill where they can now freely give us propaganda basically as news. And this has not been reported on our major news stations, as far as I know. I haven't seen anything on that. I had to go digging through like all this YouTube stuff and all this research in order to find it. But it was actually a bill that came through, the NDAA bill, that allows them to use propaganda as however they want to. They can use it as our news. They can make up false news stories or fabricate the whole thing and have us believing it as if it were true. So that basically, I guess, keeps people from suing them because they're, you know, not disclosing the truth. It takes the whole, I guess, the whole truth out of our news, out of our broadcast, right?
Right. Yeah. But again, you know, how do the masses respond or react to that? Maybe there's like an initial reaction of sort of like being indignant or, you know, somewhat being disdained. But, you know, they get over it and, you know, it's life as usual. They're just more concerned with their sort of 9-to-5 lifestyle than they are with the deeper issues of really what's going on, sadly.
Right. Now, I know that we wanted to schedule in some time to discuss the mind control and psychotronic weapons, and you've got some kind of insider information in that, according to what you and I discussed one time when we had coffee. So can you kind of get into that a little bit, Ron?
Well, I mean, yeah, actually, I used to publish a magazine many years ago called MKZine. This is back in 2003. It was an examination of coercive mind control and invasive human experimentation. And as far as psychotronic or electromagnetic weapons, they've probably been around actually since the 60s, but their implementation has probably been more around the 80s and the 90s. So it's used for, you know, different purposes. They were actually using, like, events in Panama and Somalia as sort of test models for some of those psychotronic weapons. And what they were doing is they had autopsies on various individuals. And some of these, I think even in, Grenada, too, they were using some of this stuff. Because they were doing autopsies on, you know, people that were dead, and they found out that they were fried from the inside out.
Oh, my
God.
And,
I mean, this is all documented stuff, but those were just sort of some of the first testing, I guess, of the use of psychotronic weapons. And then it was also used to some extent during the Gulf War, like in 1991. But it's also used in various degrees here in the United States. So you can have it be something that's extremely lethal, or you know, these weapons can be used simply to sort of disrupt your brainwave patterns and just drive you crazy. So.
Right. I know we had talked earlier about the targeting of individuals, and that you've met a number of people at different conferences that you've attended and different seminars. So can you share with us a little bit of the patterns that you've seen by talking to the targeted individuals, and you know, tell some stories about that, if you don't mind?
Well, yeah. There's a lot of really good organizations, too, that you can look on the Internet. I think there's the Freedom Against Covert Harassment and Surveillance. I don't know what the website is, but you can Google that. Derek Robinson is the president of that organization. But anyway, it seems like probably since the mid-90s on, there's just been a plethora of individuals coming forward saying that you know, they're hearing voices, they can't sleep, they have these weird electric sensations on their skin, you know, just all kinds of different things. And a lot of these things sort of mimic schizophrenia. So, of course, when these people went to the doctor, they were diagnosed with schizophrenia and put on, you know, large doses of psychotropic type medications and stuff, but it just seems like over a period of time, more and more people were experiencing this, and they had no prior psychological, you know, issues or mental health issues. And people like Roger Tulsis, who's an electronics expert, was helping set up diagnostic equipment for individuals who believed they were being targeted, and found out that they were indeed getting zapped by these type of devices or weapons. And, excuse me, trying to get my voice back.
Yeah, there have been a couple of things that came out that my audience may want to tune into. One is the Jesse Ventura show called Brain Invaders. That's like a 45-minute video that explains more of this. And they're tying that in with the Gwen Towers, which are, you know, were like they mentioned in the show, it's like everything old is new again. It's like the old, I think it was World War II defense system that we had, kind of
right,
like the Reagan, what do you call it, like the Star Wars type thing, the towers that they erected for that. At the top of the Gwen Towers now, they've got some type of receiver and transmitter at the top that literally targets individuals, you know, and there are thousands of people listed all over California. There are entire groups that are dedicated to this now, and they did the Presidential Commission of, what was it called? Commission of Bioethics, the Presidential Commission of Bioethics, led by Amy Gettman. So if you Google that, sorry, I kind of goofed around with that, but it's the Presidential Commission of Bioethics, led by Amy Gettman. It's kind of a long title, but if you Google that in YouTube, you'll see 20 people that give an account of this and firsthand information. So that's something that I think my audience may want to look up and look at. So in talking to some of these people, I remember we had coffee that one time, and you said that that you had actually talked to some people who'd had this experience.
Mm-hmm.
So can you share just like some general things? I don't want you to go into anything personal that would be, you know, reveal someone's name or something, but if you could kind of give us some of the experiences that they had, maybe this would help my audience understand this more.
Well, there's one individual who's a good friend of mine, and he doesn't mind using his name. His name is Jesus Mendoza. He's out of Mission, Texas, and he was a student at Cooley Law School in Lansing, Michigan in the mid-90s. And he found out that the president of the school was embezzling funds from minority students, so he kind of blew the whistle on that. And a few weeks after that occurred, he started having these weird sensations, a lot of inflammation in his body, and he went to the doctor, and the doctor said, "Man, you're suffering from radiation poisoning. You know, you have like microwave oven that's not working well." And because, of course, the doctor had no frame of reference to really draw from why this individual is being radiated. And so he says, "No, I don't." And so he started doing his own homework and found out that, you know, looking on the internet, and he sort of surmised that maybe he was being zapped because he was exposing, you know, the president of the law school. But he felt that, well, why aren't other people being zapped for, you know, a lot bigger things that are they're exposing? But then when he looked at the board of directors on the law school, and mind you, Cooley Law School is one of the most influential law schools in the country, and Jesus was about to graduate at the top of his class, but he had to quit school because of this. But anyway, he looked at the board of directors and noticed that several of them were involved in with the Department of Defense and involved in like DARPA projects or, you know, top secret electronic type stuff. And so it all sort of made sense after that. And, you know, he was married at the time and I believe had one child, and they couldn't stay in Lansing any longer because of all the targeting that was going on. His wife wasn't being targeted, which was really strange, but he was, and their young child was. So he went down to Mission, Texas, hoping, you know, he would get some relief, but it started right back up again. And so that's when he came in contact with Roger Tulsis, who helped him, you know, with some of these diagnostic devices, and he set him up, and he realized that the trajectory was coming overhead the same way a satellite would come.
Oh,
so,
man.
So basically he was getting most likely zapped by, you know, through satellites and not necessarily through a relay.
So this would be more than what came out on the Jesse Ventura show, which was the Gwen Tower technology.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was good, but they only talked about, you know, just part of it. There's just there's different ways to, you know, utilize these type of devices, and satellite is one of them. The Gwen could be one, and there's also, I think what was used back in the 90s were these vans with these sort of pop-up radars that looked like they were probably like news trucks, you know.
Yes, uh-huh.
I'd be able to see those, but essentially what they were doing is they were targeting individuals.
Wow.
It can be used in all different capacities and hidden under all kinds of different, you know, within different buildings. I know that people who live in, like, apartment complexes sometimes complain that, you know, part of the apartment complex isn't being rented out at all, you know, and that they're possibly using. And then when they set up the diagnostic equipment, it shows that, in fact, that some of these apartments are, you know, that's where it's the beams are actually being transmitted, the lasers. So
you mean they're coming through the empty apartment unit?
Exactly. Yeah.
Whoa.
Or houses, too, I've heard. People who live in a neighborhood and there might be a house that's, like, for rent or whatever, and they find out, you know, by setting up certain types of diagnostic equipment that it's coming from that particular house. So, you know, this definitely can be proven, but what's the motivation to do this? I mean, and I think, you know, as well as, you know, a lot of people who are being targeted, is to discredit or disable individuals. And before, it seemed like there was sort of a pattern in which these individuals were like whistleblowers or, you know, political dissidents or people who had worked for the federal government but, you know, were fired or whatever. So it seemed like there was somewhat of a pattern. But now it's so random. You have people that aren't involved in politics or anything that are getting zapped. Now, mind you, there are individuals, too, that do have mental health issues and will gravitate toward this, you know, to justify their condition. But, again, on the other hand, the reason, you know, this is so ingenious is because it can make a person seem like they're crazy. And more times than not, that's what they're labeled. They'll go to their doctor or psychiatrist and they'll simply label them, you know, paranoid schizophrenic. Because who can hear voices? I mean, you know, of course that technology doesn't occur, but when you look at what they call V2K or voice to skull technology, you can look it up on the internet. There's actual patents that prove that this stuff.
Yeah, you know, Frey actually created this in 1958. So imagine the years that they've had to perfect this, where this is a complete science at this point. You know, it has an invention date of 1958 with patents that far back, and then now look what they're able to do. They're able to beam, you know, directions into people's heads, even out as super soldiers. The whole super soldier conference is coming up in Henderson the 17th through the 19th, and we'll discuss this type of technology that's being used within our military, where they're not even able to need a headset anymore. They can actually beam thoughts into people's heads, where they actually know how to move as a group, you know, within a group. So all of this is technology. Yeah.
Right, and we're entering into the age of, you know, transhumanism, sort of molding machinery with the human body, and they're becoming essentially, you know, bionic. So this is no longer science fiction, but it's fact. It's occurring right as we speak today. And there's a guy by the name of John Alexander, who was a bigwig in the Army, I believe. And he also headed up some of these projects at Los Alamos National Laboratories. I just find it really interesting now that he's sort of like a whistleblower and he kind of talks about this. But to me, I think a lot of it's just containment. He'll only talk about certain things and certain issues, but he doesn't really get into the real nitty-gritty of how this is being used on unwitting subjects and, you know, why it's being used. But mostly he talks about why it's used, you know, for military purposes or crowd dispersal or, you know, and they talk about, you know, the non-lethal weaponry. But all of this can also be very lethal. And I believe several people have died because of the use of this, you know, type of weaponry.
Yes, and there's no accountability. There's no way to even pin this because it's like the active denial process, or that's part of what's going on with this, where you know, there's no way to actually pinpoint and say this is how this person died. Even a thorough autopsy will not reveal what's happened to these people. So they could die of a heart attack, an aneurysm, a stroke, you know, all sorts of different things that could have affected them, and yet science, even a well-trained person running the autopsy, would not know how to look for this. So the medical staff does not even know that this is going on. The psychologist and psychiatrist don't know that this is going on. So we have a lot of education to get out there on this whole matter, you know?
Yes, we do. And if I can refer to Paranoia Magazine, you know, my editor, Ilana Freeland, wrote a really excellent article that, you know, people can check out in the summer 2012 issue of Paranoia Magazine. And it's called This Covert Electromagnetic Era, and it's the domestic use of directed energy weapons for political control. Very excellent read. She gets into the technology and who developed it, why it's used. It's very technical, you know, so some people might, you know, find it a little wordy, per se. But another individual who has a lot of information regarding psychotronic or electromagnetic weapons is H. Michael Sweeney. And he can be found at proparanoid.com. And he's written several books. He's actually a consultant for targeted individuals. And he shows people how they can mitigate the effects of this technology in a very practical way.
Excellent. So I'd like to open up the call lines for any callers that may have come in. Ruthann, did anyone call in yet?
Not yet. No.
Oh, okay. Well, I guess we can keep moving forward. I'm really liking the discussion that's going on right now. So
yeah, and we've only got 9 minutes. So.
Oh, okay. Okay. So, Ron, what else would you like to share with us? Because you're really on a roll right now.
Right. Well, I mean, I have one other story of an individual who I had corresponded with, as well as Ilana Freeland, my editor. And her name is Diana Napolis. She actually lives here in San Diego. But back in the 90s, she was working for social services, I think something like Child Protective Services here in San Diego, and she was uncovering a lot of really nasty stuff in foster homes, and even to the extent where she found evidence of like satanic ritual abuse going on with some families. But, you know, she gave the information to her supervisors and they didn't do anything with it. And she even like wrote to the local paper, and basically they just sort of put her down. And she also did a lot of investigation on Michael Aquino, who was the founder of Temple of Set, which is an offshoot of the Temple of Satan. But he was also a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army and involved in psychological warfare. So it's really interesting how, you know, when she started uncovering this stuff and, you know, used a pseudonym on the internet, then all of a sudden she started hearing voices. And mind you, she had no, you know, psychological condition, you know, like schizophrenia or anything like that prior to this. And she started hearing the voices. Steven Spielberg and Jennifer Love Hewitt, and she couldn't sleep, and basically it was driving her crazy. And so much to the extent that she would actually go to Steven Spielberg's house and start yelling and screaming at him, saying, "Why are you doing this to me?" And so there was a restraining order, and she eventually was, you know, charged with trespassing and actually went to jail for a while.
Wow.
But she actually, she, you know, once she got out of jail and was on probation, something else happened to her. The voices started to subside, but all of a sudden she had a different reality. Her whole perception of reality was totally different. You know, she would like look in the sky and like see two suns collide, and, you know, it would freak her out. Or she'd see, you know, people sort of like transform into monsters or whatever, like she was on some sort of like LSD trip. But
wow.
Basically what was going on, and I don't know if you've ever read Dr. Robert Duncan's book.
I have. I'm reading it now for the third time.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And what's the title of that?
It's called Project Soul Catcher.
Right. So that Soul Catcher technology, I think, is being uploaded in certain individuals, possibly like Diane Annapolis, and even a friend of mine, an investigative journalist by the name of Alex Constantine, who's written several cutting-edge books back in the 90s, and both of them talk about being uploaded, of seeing these different realities. And essentially, Alex Constantine is, he's no longer writing, and he's pretty much sort of, he's not necessarily homeless, but he's just been, disabled, so to speak. But I had a talk with him, several years ago, and he just said, my life's not the same anymore. But he was another individual who was, the two individuals who were exposing Michael Aquino the most were Diane Annapolis and Alex Constantine. And both of them have the same type of sort of mindset where they're just seeing all these weird, crazy realities. And, nobody
takes it seriously. That was discussed on, I don't mean to interrupt you, but that was discussed on Dr. Robert Duncan's interview with George Norrie that came out, I believe, in 2007. So I've been listening to that over and over and over and over again because it's such good information. And he's got, I think it's a 3 to 4 hour show, a radio show with George Norrie from coast to coast on all of the psychotronic weapon stuff. So it's very scary. It's unbelievable what they can actually do. And there's no accountability. There's no way to actually prove that they're doing this to people, as far as I can tell.
Right. I mean, again, there are certain types of diagnostic equipment that can be used. However, it's very expensive for the most part. And, again, I think most people it's just too sci-fi for most people to believe this stuff exists. Again, the patents are there on the internet. They can check them out themselves. But
what would they look? What would they need to look under to actually find these, Ron?
I think all you need to do is look under mind control patents. Do a Google search, and you'll find quite a few of those. And along with the voice to skull type technology. I mean, people, you can purchase what's called a neurophone, and it's something that you can put next to your body, and you can hear these inaudible voices, right, that bypasses the regular auditory system. You can hear voices in your head. So people can play around with that, and it just proves that, this stuff exists. And, I mean, that's sort of a low-tech item, but it proves the point that this technology, in fact, does exist. And how far is this going to go? That's what really scares me.
Yeah, it's very scary, especially the fact that the majority of the public does not know about this. I wish to heavens I had a national network news station where I could get on and just blast this stuff out. So we're just relying on word of mouth to get out, basically on Facebook and our post and this radio show to try to get the word out and let people know. So little by little, people are kind of waking up and they're hearing about it, but we need a complete news blanket and a complete blast about this information. This is important stuff.
Exactly. And we have to do it in a very prudent and reliable way, in a non-sensational way, because unfortunately there are people out there who are into conspiracy, but they exaggerate or embellish certain claims that aren't true. And so I think we really have to be careful and know how to filter out and discern what's true and what's not.
I agree. Well, Ron, I've really enjoyed the show with you. We now have 2 minutes, so we're down to the wrap-up. So is there anything else that you'd like to say? And I'd also like for you to reiterate your website information where people can actually find you and know how to purchase your magazine.
Sure. Again, you can go to www.paranoiamagazine.com, and you'll find a lot of different articles in there, a lot of them that aren't actually in the magazine. And I also plan on doing a radio show probably within the next month, so look for Paranoia Radio in the not too distant future.
And I also want to do some YouTube blurbs, like a Conspiracy 101 type setup where I'm presenting various conspiracy facts and building a frame of reference, a basis of understanding for people to really understand what conspiracy is all about.
Wonderful. Well, I look forward to it. I look forward to hearing your radio show. That sounds great. Thank you so much for being on the show, Ron, and we'll have you back again.
Okay. Thanks so much, Cynthia.
Okay. Thanks so much, Ron. Bye-bye. Thank you, Ruth Ann.
Of course. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.